It's time for Mac Break Weekly. There's lots to talk about. Google I.O. was this morning, so we'll get an Apple-y take on what Google announced. We'll also talk about Apple's Q2 results that came out last week. We've had time to digest those. And you ever want to be a paper boy? How about, well, now you can, thanks to Warren Buffett and Tim Cook. We'll explain next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 660, recorded Tuesday, May 7th, 2019. 2,000 nerds on a boat. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT can be by giving their products a try for free. And by IT Pro TV, providing effective training with access to virtual labs and practice tests. Visit go.itpro.tv/MacBreak to take advantage of their lowest prices of the season. For an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription, use the code MacBreak30 at checkout. And by Capterra. Find the right tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Visit Capterra's free website at Capterra.com/MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple, starting about an hour and a half late today, only because Google had a little thing going on, a little fun in Mountain View. I know you were watching it, Renee Ritchie, because I saw you tweeting, Renee Ritchie from iMore.com.
I'm actually not Renee. I am Google's new assistant podcast host now in beta, trying to give you realistic decision tree matrix responses, Leo.
We call you Renee Duplex.
Yes, yes, but I am ethical AI, so don't worry. I'm only partially taking over the world.
And also here, and boy, are her fingers tired, typing away like crazy, Lori Gill. She's managing editor at iMore.
That's me. Yes. I was there listening, but only my attention was split between listening to Google I.O. and writing all about Power Beats Pro. So,
you and Renee both got them, huh?
I'm going to have to backtrack and re-listen to a bunch of stuff. I went last year to I.O. and it was so much fun. I wish I was there again. It's a really great experience.
It kind of, Microsoft and Google, for some reason, book back-to-back developer conferences, which is a little frustrating. I think Microsoft's going to have to rethink that strategy, because after slogging through Microsoft's keynote yesterday, which was just kind of fumbled, fingered, and uninteresting.
They don't pick a clear audience. They put a little bit for everybody, and that means everybody's a little bit bored.
And it sadly began with a massive demo fail. Before we talk about that, let me introduce Andy Iannacco from WGBH Boston. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
I know you're I know you're a space buff. Are you old enough to remember the moon landing 50 years ago?
No, not quite. My youngest memory that's space related is I think I have a distant memory of being in preschool and maybe seeing Apollo 17.
I vividly remember.
Mine is Columbia. That's the first one.
Columbia. That's a shuttle.
First shuttle launch. Yeah, the first shuttle launch, Leo.
I vividly remember Neil Armstrong stepping off the lunar module, watching Walter Cronkite through many holds of not just Apollo, but Gemini and Mercury. And I was 12 when they landed on the moon. So was Andrew Chaikin, who was on stage yesterday at Build, along with John Knoll, who, with his brother Thomas Knoll, created Adobe Photoshop, then became creative director at Industrial Light and Magic, worked on both Star Wars and Star Trek effects. And I felt so bad for them.
And they listened to the show.
What?
Yeah, I went to ILM and they came running up, and John came running up and talked about something we talked about in Mac Break Weekly, and he was listening on his way to work.
Oh,
just made my day.
Well, John, I just feel so bad because I was just as excited as they were, and John was 7, Andrew was 12 when the people walked on the moon for the first time. In fact, Andrew wrote the book about it. And did you read Janko Recker's article about it in Variety? I guess. John Knoll had been planning this since the late 90s. He found a bunch of telemetry data and was starting to work on a program to image it. because he wanted to image it. And so he'd been working on, this is a lifelong 20-year in the making project for him.
Yep.
If you, by the way, if you get a chance, read this article and then watch the rehearsal video, because it did work in rehearsal. It was supposed to be a demo of HoloLens 2 that that kind of showed the Saturn spacecraft, talked about it, the launch, showed the lunar module landing on the moon, the difficulty Armstrong faced in landing it correctly, and then his first step onto the moon in augmented reality. And it was just great. And, you know, apparently they were having trouble getting the demo working. The event that was prior to the keynote, which we had the privilege of watching as I got up early by accident, they stretched it for like 20 minutes, you know, making up questions for the participants and stuff. Finally, Reckers writes, they ran out of questions. They had to go to the main stage. Up come Chaikin and Noel, and it just, the thing won't work. And they said something like, well, it just shows getting HoloLens to work is even harder than a moon landing. and hung their heads and walked off. And I felt so bad for them. But it is if you get the chance to see the rehearsal video, it would have been spectacular.
No, the best projects that ever happen are led by people who are just mad people, just mad men and mad women who just have this idea that is not commercial, not going, there's no market for it, there's no audience for it, but they just realize themselves in their hearts that this would be an amazing thing to exist. And it's, they have the ability, the drive, and the resources to make it exist. Yeah. And that's why this idea of saying we have all of this data that will tell us every second, every step of this moon landing from preparation to trans Earth injection and landing, that we can actually rebuild this in such a way that's no longer grainy footage or statically radio. We can actually make it a real experience, so we could actually refilm it in IMAX, and so people can just really see in front of them what was happening. And again, it's not like there's a big market for this, but it was such a cool idea, you can't get rid of it, and you have to do something with it. And that's why I think that the humans are definitely still at least three steps above the elk and the porpoises in terms of being entitled to run this planet.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it was a great HoloLens demo, but that's what makes us geeks, right? Our enthusiasm for passion projects. And I just, John, if you're listening, sorry, but everybody's got to go. Here's the video. I'm just looking at it right now, and watch this. And what a great and interesting demo of what you could do with HoloLens. Of course, what we're seeing is not what you see in the HoloLens. We're seeing something much more impressive. But still, the way they're interacting with it, and they used the Unreal Engine. Epic Games participated in the recreation of this. That's another
amazing.
Yeah, really, really looks realistic.
Yeah,
it's very, very cool. I hate to talk about a Google event on a Mac show, but I guess we kind of have to.
So much of it is coming to iOS anyway.
Is most of it?
Or your Mac on a browser?
Yeah. So the assistant's going to be updated. They say 10 times faster. They're really taking a page from Apple's playbook, Renee, because a lot of this stuff is on device now, as Apple's stuff has been for some time.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be both optimistic and pessimistic about this, because we're just coming off Facebook F8, where they decided that they could say the word privacy, and that would be enough for most people without having to actually do any privacy stuff. And I think Google has way better intentions here, but Google still needs massive amounts of data, and they're candid about that. Like, you know, they'll give you the ability to erase your data in 3 months, not today, but in 3 months. And those are certainly steps forward. And what they're doing here is they've managed to shrink the data set from, I forget what they said, like 400 or 200 gigabytes.
They got it down from 200 gigabytes to 200 kilobytes.
To half a gigabyte.
Half a gigabyte. Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah.
And because of the speed on device, it was the closest thing we've seen yet to like an actual Marvel Studios Jarvis or like Knight Rider kit style demo, where you could actually have a conversation in real time. Not say something, pause, wait, say the command word again, pause, wait, say the command, but just talk conversationally, and it was launching apps and keeping up and doing everything with it. It's not shipping today, not shipping tomorrow, shipping later this year.
On the new Pixel phone, not until Pixel 4, but
yeah.
And it's not just that, though, I'm hoping it goes back a bit.
I'm sorry.
The
go ahead,
Lori. The thing that comes to my mind when I hear them talking about how this this AI can kind of answer these questions sequentially without needing to have the trigger word used, but then I immediately start thinking, well, how long is this thing listening to me then? And I think that's where it gets a little bit concerning when they talk about privacy and security. But then is this AI always listening? And is that something that we want?
Well, it is now. I mean, it's always listening for a pattern.
The only difference, well, like, I wish that they had spoken about it. Like, I wish they'd explained it. But it's like before you had AB, you had on, off, it was binary. Now there are if statements in between. And that introduces complexity, but complexity is manageable.
They've so talked about this before. I think there's a 2-minute window. Siri has this too, this contextual.
And if you yell no or stop with the alarm clock, right? So if the alarm clock is going off, then listen for no instead of the trigger.
I love that, so by the way. That might be the single most important feature that when your Google
Home
alarm. It got
the biggest applause.
It did. The alarm is going off. You can just shout stop and it will stop.
This was by far the most interesting announcement of the entire thing, moving the AI model onto the device. And for me, yes, it was privacy, but also I'm glad that they pointed out all of the implications of this, that now that we don't have to force everybody to be using the same central AI model, we can actually customize the AI model on device directly. So one of the big demos they gave, and they actually have a project name for it, is that, well, not a lot of people, they might have speech impediments or they might have certain handicaps that will make it difficult for a traditional voice model to understand them. But now they can create a model that will make sure that they understand their voice particularly. If it's on device and it's not necessarily exchanging data with Google, and like Renee says, we have to wait for further announcements and further sessions of I/O to find out the details of this. But if it really is going all on device, you have the ability to say that certain data should absolutely never be uploaded to Google. Now you have the ability to have it listen in on all of your all of your phone conversations and all of your texts. They had a great demo where they basically turned a phone conversation into a text message interaction, because it could turn into text whatever this person on the phone on the other end of the phone conversation was saying, and then turn whatever you were typing into natural sounding speech.
That's Project Euphonia, by the way, Andy, and they did solicit people who have speech difficulty. If you have somebody who knows somebody who might help them with Project Euphonia, g.co/euphonia. Can you hear? Is my sound not?
I love the non-obtrusive UI too. It doesn't block out the entire screen and lets you still see it.
And they're claiming 10 times faster.
The biggest thing for me though that was different this year is when they talked about duplexing technologies, they said it was part of a conversation. They weren't just giving you this massive tech demo. They said, we understand it's sensitive. We want to discuss this. We want to have all this. And just that subtle difference makes it so much more approachable for people and so less stressful. Yep.
That's the difference, I think, between Google and Facebook. I cannot be convinced that Facebook gives a damn about security, gives a damn about privacy. And you have to convince me that if there's any opportunity they have to collect information and make sure that you don't know that they're collecting it, if it's valuable, that they'll take it. Whereas Google, like you said, Renee, I do think that they're open and honest about why they want your information, but I do think they make a very sincere expression that we take this thing seriously. Obviously, there are things that we would like to be able to track for you, and that does benefit our business. However, we would also, in addition to explaining that to you, we would also like to explain how that allows us to do things that Shlomo on Apple can't do or can't do as well as our AI can. So as we've been saying for a long time on the show and elsewhere, it really is about the transaction between the consumer and the company that's collecting data. So long as this transaction and the details of that transaction are open and controllable by the user, I don't trust any company, even Apple, but for the lowercase version of trust that I extend to $1 billion companies, I'm willing to trust Google and I'm willing to trust Apple.
Yeah, I think Google,
from the perspective of someone that uses an iPhone pretty much exclusively. If I ever use an Android device, it's really just kind of testing something out. It's not on a daily basis. I look at this assistant from Google and think, yeah, but nobody's ever going to use that in the real world. And here's why I say that, because Siri doesn't work on iPhone very well at all. So it's useless to me. I don't use it ever because I'm constantly having to recorrect it and make it do what I want it to do. So I give up and I stop using it. So for Andy, do you use a Android product? Do you use the Google Assistant a lot? And do you see this as something that like the average Android user might use all the time because of its convenience?
I would say so. I use an Android Pixel, a Google Pixel as my daily driver, and my like smart speakers are all like Google Home devices. And as soon as the biggest impediment, I think, to using the Assistant and these other voice devices is just that you have to know that, oh, by the way, you don't have to format when you want to create an appointment. You don't have to format it. If you just simply put all the details in your request, it will figure it out and then confirm it back to you. And I think that people will continue to use this more and more as it becomes more like natural English speech. It sounds very, very naive and simple, but a big breakthrough, I think, came when one of the most basic commands, like what's the weather tomorrow? And oh, the weather in blah, blah, blah will be this. And then you can simply say, is it going to rain? Like it's not expected to, it will rain tomorrow afternoon from 4 to 6. Well, what about in Boston? In Boston, it will be clear and sunny. How about in Boston the day after that? And you're not saying, you don't have to repeat these commands over and over again. It feels like a natural conversation. When they're able to expand that little by little, month by month, into other things that we want to do, like, hey, Guillermo, I've got some avocados that are going to go bad tomorrow, and also some sour cream, and I really bought way too many carrots. What can I cook that can use all this stuff up? And it will tell you here's what you can do. And these are times when Shlomo responds with, here are some things on the web I found about this thing.
Right,
it's like,
exactly.
Oh, Shlomo, I love you, but I really want you to be better than you are.
Yeah.
Well, Google has the same problem. Apple has this problem, too. You know, in order for this stuff to work, they need more information. Apple's choice is not to collect it. As a result, Shlomo ain't that great. Google, I think, probably is taking the middle road here. You know, Facebook's just going to collect it. And Google's trying to take the middle road, saying, well, we're going to let you know we're collecting it. We are going to give you some options. But honestly, if you want the best experience with Assistant, and they showed things, you know, the contextual understanding that the Assistant had that really require it, knowing everything about you. You know, they had made restaurant recommendations, you know. Well, in the past, you could ask it, what should I cook for dinner tonight? And they, you know, they would show you based on your search results. You know, it's not like they know what's in your fridge, although that's just a matter of time. But what's important is, I think they said at the bottom of each recommendation, how they knew that. And they needed to do more stuff like that. Do more stuff on the phone, you know, collect the data, but give you the chance to delete the data after a period of time. And that's what I think that's going to be the new Google.
Can you imagine if Instagram ads did that? People would stop panicking about their devices listening in on them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, exactly.
Yeah. And I also like the fact that Google does appear to be listening. The fact that they made like privacy as one of like the three pillars for the next version of Android, saying that this is explicitly something that we're working on because a not just because we know that we're about to be regulated out of existence by the EU and by Congress any day now, but we do know that this is something that is important for us to do. So that's what we're going to do for you guys. It was another intriguing thing of saying that, well, we're going to add incognito mode to maps. We're going to add incognito mode to search. So if you don't want this, if you don't want certain things to be visible to Google, you can still use maps, a dumber version of maps, but they won't know that you were going to, you know, a certain part of town.
The third time today, Andy.
I suspect if they give people the choice and people can see the trade-off, that people will choose to give Google the information because there's value in it. Right, Lori?
Yeah, I completely agree. We just need the choice. When it's done without our knowledge, it feels like somebody's trapping us or somebody's spying on us. But if we're giving them that choice, I've always felt this way. Transparency is the most important thing. We can look at this information and decide for ourselves that we want to give it to them in exchange for whatever convenience. But when it's all being done without our knowledge and without us understanding what's really being done with our data, that's when it starts to get creepy and weird, instead of something you feel like you're exchanging for, like, a good service. So yeah, right. I think that's very true. Let us know what we're doing. Give us the choice to accept or decline that, and then we feel like we're in charge of what's happening with our data.
At this point, it looks like Google is ascendant in terms of what it can do with AI and its voice assistant. It isn't the number one seller by even close. Amazon's Echo beats everybody. Should Apple do what Microsoft has done? Microsoft threw in the towel yesterday. They basically said, yeah, so we got a voice assistant, but we figure you'll use it to interact with other voice assistants, which is their strategy. And then you're going to use it in business. What should Apple, what do you think, Renee, what should Apple do about Siri at this point?
I think, I would be more concerned if they hadn't just made a huge investment in building up a whole new organization within the company. You know, they got John Gianandrea in, used to run search and AI at Google, so he's got the credentials. They're hiring people. I'm blanking on his name, but the guy who did the adversarial networks.
The GAN stuff,
and they're really, And they're building out that team the way they built out Johnny Cerugi's Silicon team.
But they don't, they can have the smarts, but they don't have the data.
So I think that's, I'm not sure about that, because there are different ways to handle data. So, and I think there's a lot of conflation that goes on here. One is that there are a lot of sources for data. So they, like, for example, they trained Face ID on tens of thousands of faces. They just didn't use customers. They brought in tens of thousands of volunteers. That doesn't scale. But there are ways to accumulate data and not use it for the business. So if you, like, for example, if you're okay with data harvesting, but you don't want that used for drone programs, you don't want that used for advertising, you don't want that used in a business sense, that's still a huge opportunity. And I think they also realized when they were starting to get into the healthcare stuff that you can't be absolutist about this. There are situations, for example, they talked about it with the MS study, where people just, they can't enter their own data, and you have to provide ways for them to share that. And I think that there are a lot of, Gianandrea's whole thing is ethical AI. Like, he was one of the biggest proponents of doing AI, but doing it in a way that was ethical and for the good of the people sort of thing. And they can do a lot of stuff to collect data, to anonymize it where it makes sense, to de-identify it, to do a lot of other things and still get enormous value from it without then turning around and using it to fund an advertising business, which some people just see as a conflict.
Yeah, that is a conflict. I mean, that is Google's bottom line. It's not Apple's bottom line. So inherent conflict. Google is taking a page from Apple's playbook, though. I mean, they're clearly seeing all that.
Well, I remember that a few years ago, they did what was a pretty outrageous step at the time, which is to define themselves as, we are an AI company. All of our products are extensions of artificial intelligence. Just like Apple, I think, has not announced, but they do define themselves as a design company or as a human product company. And everything that they do gets filtered through that mindset. But although we're slagging a lot on Shlomo right now, realize that Apple does a lot of things inside the lab that aren't constrained by their own rules. So they are definitely looking at ways that they could create, that they could ways that they could make Siri as capable as the assistant once certain technologies that allow them to implement these features in a private and secure way becomes available. And there's a whole bunch of theory on differential privacy coupled with the ability to move the AI model from the server onto the device. We don't know that maybe 2 years from now, all of these Legos will click back into place inside the labs inside Apple. And rather than being able to create a really great and impressive new demo and new release every single year, we'll get all of that all at once in 2 years' time, only with all of the privacy that comes with an Apple product.
Maybe.
And it's also important
You're
to remember
very
that
optimistic.
Steve Jobs.
I don't know.
No, it's also important to remember that Steve Jobs died, Scott Forstall was fired, and Bill Stainer joined the company and took over Siri. I think he'd been there for weeks at the time. So there was like a whole lost dark age of Siri where just nobody cared about it. And now there's someone with the best credentials in the world caring about
it. There's a point at which you do what Microsoft's done, which is that we are so far behind now. I mean, the race. The race is really to Amazon and Google at this point.
But that's okay. That's what happens when a company knows what it's about, like knows what its business is.
Yeah.
Microsoft, I think one of the smartest things they ever did was forget about being the first to anything or being the we've got the next and greatest and most wonderful and speculative technologies. They know that we are the ugly grease gun that keeps the wheels of business moving.
Yeah.
And it will never be pretty. It will never necessarily be elegant. But if we can, although we'd love to have like the sort of artificial intelligence assistant that everybody thinks, oh my God, I can't believe that such thing. We are living in a world of the future. If it makes Microsoft Office Suite and Microsoft Windows a better business product to say, you know what, why should we try to compete with the greatest AIs in the world when we can just simply make our operating system and software the most open in the world to whatever AI and voice assistant that you're using?
That's
a really good thing.
That's exactly what Nadella has done. Although yesterday at Build, they did have a video of a continuous conversation with Cortana, but a couple of big differences. One, Google's was a live demo with an actual person holding a phone. Two, it was a woman walking through her day, her agenda, her meeting schedule. It was very business focused for Microsoft. For Google, it was, let me show you pictures of my last trip. And, you know, obviously they both could do either. But I think it's pretty clear from a consumer point of view that people are going to want what Google does.
Yeah, I think it's very telling that we are perfect. I almost naturally say whenever there's a microphone in my presence, wherever it is, I always say Alyosha, and I always say I always say Guillermo, and I always say Shlomo. But I say Cortana without any mental health.
Yeah, nobody's
what are the chances someone has
nobody's begging us stop saying Cortana. Not
so
yet.
I think
anyway.
When it comes to AI and this digital assistant thing, the race to be the best, you know, like you're saying, it comes down to Google and Amazon, really. Who are the ones that are making smart home speakers that are the most popular? It's those two companies.
That's right.
Apple only makes a HomePod. Is there any Windows?
There's any one. Yeah, smart it's speaker? From Harman Kardon. It's called the Invoke.
So when you think about what makes a smart assistant really important to people, it's that speaker.
Right.
On their phones, it's a That's little right. less important because you can just do it on that. So I'm thinking that in this situation, Amazon and Google, they have multiple smart speakers out on the industry, and that's why they're trying so hard to be the best at what they're doing and why they're working, you know, with AI so much. But I don't think that in terms of who's going to buy the next Apple product versus who's going to buy the next Google product, I think they're so different that Apple is not assuming that because the Google Assistant is better than the Apple Assistant that you won't buy an iPhone for it. Right. So they're not working as hard to meet that standard.
A lot of that Google stuff is available on your, will be available on your iPhone. Although Google today announced that they have, 2.5 billion active devices, which is almost exactly double what Apple announced in its analyst call.
But there's a big difference there. Remember that 2.5 billion devices equals like the blister pack phones that sell for next
but
to
they're
nothing.
Still but all of them are collecting data regardless of how much it costs.
Most of them are. Yeah, you're right.
So they have a lot more inputs. We'll talk about the quarterly results, the second quarter results, because when we parted last week, Lori and Renee were about to launch into a marathon analyst call, and I'd like to know what their thoughts are.
Can I just ask one more Google question before we move on, Leo?
Sure.
So, like, the one thing I thought was really interesting is the way that they positioned the Pixel 3a. Like, if I was them, I would have come out and said, look, we made the Pixel, and it's obvious that a lot of more of you want access to that technology. So we made the Pixel 3a. But they decided to kind of sort of blame higher-end phones for some of the Pixel woes and talk about how they could make a cheaper phone. But at that point, when they start saying, you know, we don't need the hardware, we can do it all in software, I just want to ask, why not just release that camera app then? Because there are like third-party ports of it to other phones, and people are saying, works great on my Poco phone.
Yeah, in fact, the 3A does not have that dedicated DSP chip that the more expensive Big Brother has, and yet... I was looking at Dieter Bohn's review in The Verge. He had an early version, and his review was off embargo as soon as they announced it. He said it's every bit as good. The camera's every bit as good on the 3A as it is on its more expensive.
And if they're competing with their own vendors and they're competing based on camera, and that camera turns out not to be hardware exclusive, and Google is Google, it makes you wonder why there just isn't the Google camera.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised at some point if they do that. In fact, one of the ways Google's handling the problem Android has with updates and they doubled down on it again today, is, well, we're moving more and more of the system into the App Store. So whether the manufacturer, the carrier wants you to or not, we can update it, and you will update it from the App Store. That's big news for people who are stuck on Android 4 or Android 5, and there's no way to get it updated.
To answer Renee's question, I think that competitiveness is part of the equation for sure. But I think another part of it is how binary the operation of a camera app is. One of the greatest features of the iPhone's camera app will always seem to be that, without question, if you tap on the camera app icon, it launches in a split second. And every time you tap that round button, you get a picture. If you hold it down, you always get a sequence of pictures without delay. And with the, even on a Pixel phone, the Android camera app works that way 97% of the time.
Every once in a while, you sit. Just sitting and there holding the bag.
Like, well, I guess, like, hey, Guillermo, open my drawing app because I need to draw a picture of the thing.
I guess I'll memorize this event.
So apparently, they don't jet send the memory fast enough or something in some cases.
I think that part of the problem is releasing it as a general app and making sure that people will not have a horrible experience on their phone, even if they just limit it to like the top six phones.
That's what Apple's advantage is. They make the hardware and the software.
Yeah.
And to be fair to Apple, even when Google does make the hardware and the software, it's not always perfect.
Yeah, so that's good. And that may be an Android limitation as well. Yeah. One other thing, as long as we're talking about the phone, I was thrilled to see no notch and a headphone jack.
Yep.
But is that saying that people who can't afford more expensive phones don't deserve a notch?
I think this whole three announcement is Google's version of what Apple did with the Mac Pro. We goofed, is what they're saying.
Mea culpa.
Mea culpa. Because, in fact, in their quarterly results, they said the Pixel did not sell well. There were, what do they call it, headwinds.
And this is like a Pixel, right? Like, this is a Google phone that everyone is used to.
I think it's inexpensive,
utilitarian.
They acknowledge we're charging too much. People don't want a notch, and they do want a headphone jack. And I hope, in a way, this is Google's mea culpa saying, okay, you want that? We'll give you that.
I think it's that they can read the numbers as well as anybody else. There's not as much money in the Android market, both for apps and for hardware, as there is in the iOS market, which, remember that any Apple product is almost by definition of that logo, a premium luxury brand product. So I think they acknowledge that there are people who've started to lose its taste for $800 phones, particularly when there are really great $500 phones out there. And we want to sell hardware. We want to put devices in people's hands. So we're at least going to add this to the mix.
And like OnePlus is getting huge buzz. There's a lot of really good, too expensive phones. And I think the rumor was that Google really badly wanted an iPhone. And I think we already have an iPhone. There's something that Google can do that's way more interesting than an iPhone. And it sounds like they're getting back to that.
We're going to talk about the quarterly results in a bit. But Apple's not seeing the same headwinds on the high-end expensive phones that Google's seeing, right?
I mean, they're down, but everyone is the other part. It's not just that the phones are expensive, because there's always going to be people who, for many different reasons, want a premium phone or just want an iPhone. But the phones are so good. It's like what happened to computers a decade ago. Like, there's only certain things you need to do with them, and they can all do those things. And so you start to do the math in your head about how often do I really need the new version?
Right.
Yep. As I said before, my daily driver is still a Pixel version 1. Because I just, every time that there's a brand new phone, I contemplate spending $800 for the latest phone, whether it's an iPhone or a Pixel 3. And then I look at my existing phone, which is working great and actually doesn't even have a scratch on it. And I think, there are other things I could do for that $800.
Well, and you're not alone, Andy. That's exactly what's going on in the phone market these days. Yeah.
The new phones now offer you a couple new features. The new phones then offered you much less pain in certain areas. And that was an easier modifier.
Yep.
Let's take a little break. Come back with more. Renee Ritchie, great to have you from iMore.com. He's getting ready for Detective Pikachu Day, which begins in 15 minutes. Do you still play Pokemon Go? I can't remember.
I do, but I've told you, I declared Pokemon bankruptcy because they were just too, like, I think someone on Reddit did the math and it would take 42 minutes just to do the basic stuff every day. And I don't have that kind of time.
Yeah.
So I'll do like Community Day. I'll do like the new raids when they come out. I'll do anything special, but I'm not doing like the Cupcake Factory time management stuff.
Yeah, I used to like that kind of game, the Cupcake Factory time management. You know, the get the princess to the woods before the
But woodsman. Then I lose my time. Like, I lose my real world time management to the stupid game.
Suddenly you realize, my God, if I had spent that much time learning how to play an instrument.
I could drive to Ottawa and back in the time it takes for one community daily. Yeah. What am I doing?
Exactly.
I read the news a lot more now that I stopped playing Pokemon Go.
I don't know if that's a good thing, though. Lori Gill, she's managing editor at iMore.com, along with Renee Ritchie, and, of course, from WGBH Boston, it's Andy and Otko. Our show today brought to you by our IT department, frankly. I'm looking at you guys. You do a great job. In fact, really every business, it's not just podcasts, but every business relies on the cloud these days. More and more, that's where your data lives. That's where your apps live. That's where your customers live. And IT teams are at the center of the revolution. Staying competitive in an increasingly cloud-based world requires IT teams to plan, to execute faster than ever. Incidents require open, agile, and smart coordination between teams, between ops, the software dev teams. They require communication with the customers, the stakeholders, your boss. Atlassian powers it all. Atlassian collaboration software powers IT teams around the world. It all starts with Jira. I've used Jira for a long time. Any agile developer knows Jira. But, you know, it's not just for programmers. It's not just for developers. Jira can keep track of all your projects. With Jira, we know who's responsible for what stage it's at, how it's going. It's really a great way to keep track of what's going on in your IT department. And then, of course, we really rely on Jira's partner Confluence, because that's where we document the changes, the workflow, so that we can communicate better. Atlassian software isn't just for developers. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all sizes, from DevOps to Agile, IT apps to Ops to ITSM, and whatever's next. Atlassian provides the technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support the kind of change that propels business. So you've got Jira, you've got Confluence. If you've got a code database, you need Bitbucket. If you've got operations to manage, websites or apps or SaaS solutions, you need Ops Genie and Status Page. They help teams better detect incidents, coordinate response issues, resolve issues faster, keep customers and stakeholders updated. And it all integrates seamlessly with Jira and Confluence, kind of the hub. That way your team doesn't have to bounce around from app to app. Everything you need, every tool you need, whatever your current framework is and however you grow, is available at Atlassian.com. All the tools are easy and free to try at Atlassian.com/IT. Go there right now to find out which Atlassian offerings are right for your team. Try Atlassian today to see what IT can be. Atlassian.com/IT. We're proud to be an Atlassian house here at TWIT, and we thank them for their support. So the colors are out. Jason Snell, he says it's just a script. He just runs a script, and all the graphs are generated. So let's go through it. You, Renee, and Lori were on the phone call listening last week. What's the top line? Renee, what is the number that we should be paying attention to?
Typically it's forecast for next quarter. They beat the estimates, which is always important because you always want to do less badly than Wall Street thinks you might.
That helps the stock price.
Yeah, and they did. Well, I mean, that's the weird thing. If we dig down deep into this, Apple for many, many years, for almost a decade, made more money than companies that had oligopoly control over fossil fuel resources, and Wall Street punished them for it because they thought each time they will never be able to repeat it. And quarter after quarter. Yeah, they did it. And now the iPhone business is going down. It went really far down. Now maybe it's leveling off. But the services story is going up, and Wall Street was like, yay, they rewarded the stock.
Company posted revenue of $58 billion. That's down year over year about 5%. But there are some bright lights. iPad revenue up 22%. Of course, they had new iPads. Services.
Although it was the Pro, they said, that drove that. The new iPad, the frosting on the Pro cake.
Ah, yeah. Interesting. Well, I love those, that Pro.
Yeah.
And with the prospects of iOS 13 making it really a Pro device, I can see why people might be interested. Services revenue, we knew that would go up 16%. Mac revenue, sad to say, down 5%. I'm not surprised.
Well, the most interesting thing about that, though, is that, you know, Apple is typically really classy about Intel. They didn't mention Intel's name, but they said that Mac revenue was down because they could not get the chips from a supplier. Yeah. And that had they been able to get the chips they needed, Mac revenue would have been up.
Not everybody is as classy as Apple. Intel's name has been... People are shaking their fists at Intel.
But they only can they not do 10 nanometer, they can't supply the 14 nanometer chips that they're supposed to supply in a timely fashion. And on top of that, they still haven't built in basic things like support for larger amounts of the faster, lower power memory, or things like better display port standards. So you have to still work around the chips even when you get them.
Apple said if we'd had the chips, we could have sold many more... MacBook Airs, right? The demand was high, but they just couldn't fulfill it.
Yeah.
Looking at the revenue on the pie chart, iPhone is a little more than half, 54% of total revenue. And then I think it's actually fairly well divided up. Services is growing and growing now, one-fifth of all app and revenue. But I think that's a fairly good distribution. You'd like to see, you know, iPhone continue strong, but you'd like to see services make up some of the difference. The revenue is... pretty much what you'd expect for a fourth quarter. You could see those dips second quarter, every Q2, you could see those dips.
And wearables did great again, too. Both watch and AirPods performed really well for them.
That's good. Revenue down a little bit. But again, this is a very cyclic business. When you look at charts like that, you can really see the cycles. It's just, you know, exactly what you'd expect. iPad revenue changed the best ever, 22% year over year. Yeah.
Mm. I wonder what that says about the iPad market these days, where people, the big tentpole release last year was the iPad Pro, whereas the tentpole release the year before that was the $329 education-oriented iPad. So I wonder what that says about what the overall market for iPad is. Is it people that really do want to spend $1,000 for something that will allow them to keep their laptops at home, or home users who want something that throws away everything that's cumbersome about a desktop operating system? Or is it really people who want to get the lower price points, who really just want an ancillary product for their computing world?
Is the Mini or the new Air, are they in this or no? They came out after.
They're at the very end of the quarter. So they had, I forget how many weeks, it was only a couple of weeks into the quarter.
So you won't, So as you said, it's the iPad Pros that are driving this.
Well, that was a big update trigger for a lot of people. When the new design comes out, a lot of people make that decision. It helps them. It encourages that decision.
Yeah.
And it was a substantive update. Yeah. It feels different. It moves differently. So that's, if you were waiting for a new iPad Pro, this is what got you to go.
Yeah. I'm glad, because the iPad had been kind of moribund for the last few years. So I'm glad to see that. Services is exactly as I think on target as Tim Cook probably wanted. I mean, that is a very steady growth. What more can you say? This is going to be a revenue driver going forward more and more. Revenue up 16%. It's been up more in other quarters, but as you can see, when you look at the graph of revenue quarter by quarter.
And this is still pre-TV Plus, pre-Apple Card, pre-Apple Arcade.
Absolutely. So. That's right. Wearables, home accessories, increase of 5.1%. I'm sorry, no, 5.1 billion, my apologies, in revenue. That's down from last quarter, but highest for Q2 in some time. In fact, ever, it looks like. Total Apple revenue also down a little bit, but as you said, they beat the street. Profit $11.6 billion. A tidy sum, but still.
And we have that in 20s and singles.
Yeah. So I don't know. Is there anything else to say about this?
And Tim Cook said they buy a new company like once every 2 weeks. Yeah. Like once a week or every 2 weeks or something. No big deal.
Wow. China, he said, is starting to come back. That's going to be very important. Lori, you were listening. Anything you heard that you thought was important on this call?
I mean, you're just, the numbers that you're talking about are basically the same. I think for me, like, the one thing that stood out the most was one of the last things that was mentioned was whether or not the market in India was going to be difficult for Apple to break into because there's so many Android users there. And The response was, well, it's actually good that there's so many people using Android, because that just means there's more people for us to get to turn into iPhone users. Wow. You know, so
that's the silver lining. Okay.
Yeah.
But not just that, unstated is that if they Apple has yet to indicate that they can really compete on anything that anything that's mid-range price or lower. But if the entire world is buying phones that are capable of running Apple Music, that are capable of running Apple TV, that are capable of subscribing to Apple News, that can also be a big win for Apple. So they'll take money from anybody. They don't care to see if their blood runs in the Apple original logo colors.
The China stuff was good, but then we had
we have tariffs.
Yeah, we had the tariff news come out right afterwards, and all those gains just started being clawed right back.
Yeah. Is Apple, so in the past, the iPhone has not been subject to those tariffs. Is this new plan, which is not yet in effect, but would it affect
iPhones?
It's
so ambiguous because, and everything is classified differently. Like in some countries, if it looks like a watch, it's a watch, but otherwise it's a computer, and it's hard to tell country by country. But if you apply, let's just say you apply a steady 25 to everything, then that changes a lot of stuff.
It really did surprise me that Apple's bought 24 companies, because you don't really hear, that's in the last 6 months, you don't really hear about these. They're not big news. Are they smaller companies? Is that why? Or
specific talent and technology acquisitions. And Apple, if you find out about it and ask them, they will say Apple from time to time acquires a company, and we don't generally discuss our future plan.
Right.
Typically, they're like $8 million to $20 million acquisitions, so they're not.
Yeah. Still stunning, because
they're not that big. I would like Apple to buy my company for $8 million. Thank you very much.
There you go.
You get Lori too. Wait a minute, don't do that.
Apple, if you're listening, I'll underbid her by $80.
Oh, let's get a bidding war going.
$1. Oh no, wait. Oh.
I'm a freelance journalist. I will take canned and dented food that is within its non-perishable date.
So Tim was at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting when he gave this interview to CNBC. I'm not sure.
He did a lot of interviews over the last year or so.
But still, that's kind of an amazing statistic. If we have money left over, says Cook, we look to see what else we can do. We acquire everything we need that can fit and has a strategic purpose to it.
Well, I mean, M&A moved under Tim Cook out from Luca Maestri, and people were assuming that meant that Apple was going to finally target Tesla and Netflix and Disney and all the giant purchases of their pundit dreams. And I think this was Cook just saying, no, we do this all the time. This is a change in reporting structure because we want to stay dynamic. Please don't read too much into it.
Yeah, I got schooled. I can't remember who schooled me, if it was Horace Dediu or maybe Jean-Louis Gasset, or perhaps it was from Neil Seibert. But I think it was Neil Seibert who explained acquisitions. Big acquisitions are tough. You have the culture clash. You have to merge these two big behemoths together. Little acquisitions make a lot of sense for intellectual property, for engineers. They're useful strategically, a lot easier to assimilate into the company.
And they're still integrating Beats. Like Beats, that was 2014.
Yeah.
And I think Beats, you know, they still have a lot of Beats people in Los Angeles, and they still have other offices. Yeah.
Well, they have the power Beats. And go ahead. I'm sorry, Lori.
When these large companies are just buying up a bunch of small companies, is this beneficial to creative development, or does it stifle it? Because on the one hand, I see it as being good for creative development, because the end goal would be that somebody like Apple or Google or Amazon or somebody like that would buy you out. So that means you did a great job of creating and innovating. But on the other hand, if the end result is that somebody's just going to buy you out anyway, how far are you going to grow creatively?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent, excellent point. I really do think that there's a brain drain that happens as these small companies get bought and sublimed into Google and Facebook and Apple and all these other companies. Before they can become the next Apple, before they can become the next Instagram or Facebook, it's going to be difficult to see if that's good for the industry or bad, because we need pirates. We need mutants. We need people who are like, so.
Is anybody ever going to be the next Apple, or is Apple just going to buy them up before they get the opportunity to do that? And if that's the case,
Google never sold to Facebook, never sold to Google. Google never sold to Yahoo. And Snap refused to sell to Facebook or Google. So some of them keep going.
Yeah, but that was eons ago. That was like the early 2000s could be like 100 years ago. It's like a steam-based economy back then.
Really? It was the Gilded Age. So you, Renee, and you, Lori, have Power Beats.
Power Beats Pro. Make sure you say that right.
The new ones.
There's a lot of different things called Power Beats, so you got to make sure you use the right
one. I'm not hip with the kids, as you know. I don't really know much about it.
You got to find a flex your Power Beats.
So the Power Beats Pro are the ones that basically are Beats versions of the AirPods, right? Or no?
Yes, in terms of software, yeah.
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 They have a little charging case. They do have an over-the-ear hook. So who should I start with? Should I start with you, Lori? What do you think?
She's the expert.
Yeah, start with me.
Start with you. $250, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Pricey. So just from the time, I got them yesterday morning, I think at 8:30 in the morning, popped them in my ears immediately and spent 7 hours with them in my ears. I took them out for about 20 minutes to charge them up again, but they were in my ears all the rest of the day. So I have a little bit of experience already in their quality. And I can say that in terms of how well they work, whether or not they're, you know, like the great top of the line quality, for that extra $100, you're paying for the Beats brand. So if you're talking about AirPods versus Power Beats Pro, you're paying for the brand.
The Beats waveform, right? I mean, because did they sound really good bass heavy sound?
Yes. Yeah, so then I, of course, had to experiment with a bunch of different music. And thank you to everyone on Twitter who suggested songs to me, because that gave me the ability to really like expand outside of what I would.
What did you ask? Did you say, what's a good song to listen to on Beats headphones?
I said, what do you want me to test with it? Okay. And so a bunch of people, I even had somebody recommend their own personal band, which I thought was pretty cute, I haven't listened to yet. I had a really long list to go through.
How is voice? That's the, you know, always what I'm interested in as a podcaster. And radio.
Well, so I haven't done any phone conversations with it yet, speaking on the phone with anybody yet. But I've been using this for like right now I'm using it, and it sounds exactly the same way it does when I'm using my Bose in-ear headphones with a wired cord.
And so I don't sound all bassy and boom, boom, boom.
You sound exactly like Dre, Leo. Everybody sounds exactly like Dre.
Well, that sounds all right.
No, and see, that's what I thought was so interesting. I tested a bunch of different music before I went into the hip hop genre, and everything sounded great and well balanced and was full and rich. And I even said it reminded me of the first time I listened to a HomePod, in that it was just full and rich sounding. It wasn't off balance. But then I switched over and listened to some hip hop music, and it was like I was standing next to a car with the windows rolled down and the big woofers in the back. It was just boom, boom.
It must be that like there's just a notch at 100 hertz or something where they just boom.
Yes. But so if you... Of course, I'm just kind of jumping in with my assumptions here, and I don't know for sure, but coming from never having owned a pair of Beats headphones, I can say that if you're worried that your rock and roll or your heavy metal or your opera music is going to sound bad because it's bass heavy, that's not the case with these headphones, with the Power Beats Pro. It gets bass heavy when it's intended to be bass heavy music. So if you're listening to hip hop music, you want to feel that beat. You want it to be really bass heavy. It doesn't affect things, from what I can tell, when you're listening to other kinds of music. And I purposefully always test my headphones with music I'm really familiar with, so that I can really pay attention to whether or not it's messing with the sound of my favorite songs or with songs that I know really, really well. And I didn't see it negatively affecting or overdoing it in the bass on any of those songs. It's only when I switched over to hip hop music that has already bass heavy music in it that I started noticing it. And interestingly, a lot of the older hip hop bands from, you know, way back in the day, like Biggie Smalls and Nas and stuff like that, it wasn't bass heavy on those. It was bass heavy on more current music, like Lil Yachty or something like that. So I thought that was interesting too, that even the older hip hop wasn't reverberating with that super heavy bass beat that I was hearing in some of the newer stuff. So
this is from goldenears.net, but this is a review of earlier 2013 era Beats headphones. But this is the comparison of a flat curve, that's the blue line, and the Beats curve, which is the green line. And as I suspected, it's around about 100, between 100 and 200. Maybe the peak is at 150 hertz there that you get a boost. And then there's a little drop. Now, I don't know if the Power Beats are like this. I'd love to see somebody do this. There's a 5 dB down at 500 hertz, and the rest of it is almost identical. So if you were going to say this is the classic Beats curve, this is the Beats by Dre, it would be, you know, this in the bass area. And you're right, it's such a narrow notch. It probably wouldn't affect most music, and you know, only music that's mixed with those particular frequencies in mind.
That's a really great note, Lori, because I do, every time I've tried Beats headphones, it just muddles everything. And
like
I've always
that.
Thought that it's, yeah, and the idea that if it's indeed selective, that it only really brings the pain when you've got a track that's designed to bring the pain on the bass line. That's actually quite good.
Yeah.
I listened to prehistoric hip hop like Grandmaster Flash and Melly Mel and LL Cool J. My reference is the biography of Mr. Chuck from Public Enemy, and that was really, really good. And I did do a bunch of calls, and I called Georgia when she was on her way to work this morning, and she said, "What's that whistling?" And I go, "What whistling?" She goes, "Oh, that's the birds outside." So she could hear the birds while I was talking to her. She could hear me. But I don't know if she should have been hearing the birds. You know, I think that's the kind of stuff that you could cancel out. So I don't know I don't know exactly how well the call cancellation is. I have to do some other calls, obviously, with birds around to see if I can find a baseline for bird chirpiness headphone.
It sounds like it would be fair to say that these are the AirPods for Beats fans. So if you know if you like the Beats sound, and you're a Beats fan and you want the features of the AirPods, this would be the sensible choice.
Well, one added thing is that the AirPods just don't fit all the time. And so like for me, I like the left one is fine. The right one's a little loose. So I can't do like Copaero or like acrobatics or anything. But with these, they're on my ear. So if I wanted to do anything super active, even if I liked AirPods, I'd go with these instead.
There are lots of other headphone choices, not AirPods, but Bluetooth wireless.
But I love the convenience. Like that's the thing. People are like, oh, they're so expensive for what they sound like. But the price has never been about the sound. It's been about that H1 chip and those accelerometers and those other sensors in there. That's the miniaturized expensive technology. So once you get like Lori had it in her review, like no strings to hold me down. Once you go all Ultron about it, it's really hard to go back. And then then you're like, but it's falling out. So this if you love that, they're both absolutely independent. You can wear one or both and it doesn't matter. Total freedom. You can get up, walk around, no strings at all. Plus, they'll stay on your ears even if you do backflips. It's like the bonus.
And that's the hook? You think that's because of the hook, the over-the-ear hook?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's also, yes, it's the hook, but it's also the way the bud itself presses into your ear. It goes deeper into your ear canal than AirPods, which for somebody like me, that's a good thing that AirPods don't go that deep in your ear because it's very painful. But this uses the silicone sort of super soft cushiony padding, so it can go deeper into your ear, which means it's anchored better into your ear too. So even if I had removed the hook entirely from these things, it would still stay in a lot better than AirPods would, though it would fall out with a lot of use, but it would certainly stay in better than AirPods because of the silicon tip that's in there, kind of deeper into your ear canal.
I don't know why. I seem to collect these things. My preferred wired headphones are the Edemotics. Yes, I do know why. But I use, these are the Jabra Elite and the Jabra Sport Elite, and they're very similar. They don't have the over-the-ear thing, but they have the very similar, and you fit these, by the way. Do the Power Beats give you a variety of tips, or there's only one?
Yes. They give you four different
chicken
sizes.
Nugget versus junior burger, Leo. Chicken nugget versus junior burger.
You got a few, don't you? That's
slider.
that's what you want, because you want to find a tip that fits your ear. Everybody's ear is a little bit different. The Jabras, I think, come with six or seven different
Which are you
tips.
Using, Lori? Which tip do you settle on?
The very smallest one. So they come with the default.
It's in the middle, right?
Mediums. It comes with the medium to high medium. So there's like the high, the big, the medium to big, the medium to small, and the small, to put it that way. And I actually put them in my ears for 3 hours with the default ones, the medium to big. And it didn't hurt at all. And then I pulled them out of my ears and I felt like I had just ripped the inside of my ear out because I didn't realize it was putting all this pressure on my ear until I removed it. So I immediately switched over to the very smallest size, and that it's been like I said, I had, so of the 7 hours, three of them, it was with the larger size, and then it hurt when I pulled them out. And for the rest of the 4 hours, it was with the smallest size ones, and it was perfect for me.
Yeah, my wife's ears are very small. No, nothing will fit. She can't wear the AirPods. They just fall out because they're too big. She likes our sponsor, the Trex Airs. I do, too, because they don't even go in the ear. And so they're the most comfortable. Oh, yeah. You could wear those all day.
There's rumors that Apple, I mean, Beats has made the over the ear, and there's rumors Apple are going to do the over the ears too. And that's a good solution if people just can't or don't want anything in their ear.
Yeah. And of course, as a DJ, I wore over the ear headphones for years.
Did you hold the one can, Leo, let the other one just fall off?
Not that kind of DJ. A radio talk show host. I like the over the ear because those are the most comfortable. You know, those are really, you can wear those all day.
I actually end up having a problem with some over-the-ear headphones because they're always a little bit too big for me, and so they press on my jaw.
Oh, yeah.
And then that
you got to get them sized so they neither press on your ear nor any other part of you.
Right, yeah. Headphones aren't usually made with tiny heads in mind.
They're very personal. Well, now we know because you look like you have a normal head on screen, but we've enlarged it. Now
I'm using a screen stretcher. Actually,
now the truth is out.
Did you guys test out these with like non iPhones and just like as a regular Bluetooth headset?
I'm using with a Mac. I haven't tried it with anything that's not an Apple product right now. Again, we just got these yesterday, so we're still working on all the other things to test them. Let me say this because Renee, maybe you already knew this, but PowerBeats Pro and the AirPods 2 use the H1 chip, which has the voice-activated Siri. You do not have to be the person calling out to Siri to stop music or play music or fast. So my significant other, while I've got these in my ears, he can tell Siri to stop playing
music. Oh, that's not good.
It will stop playing music.
Well, maybe that is good.
I just discovered
good
that.
Good for parents.
Lori, I'm trying to talk to you.
Yeah, you can do that, but do you want that? Maybe I don't want to listen to my significant other.
Why do you think I'm wearing headphones, Buster?
But with, I mean, they do mention specifically, Andy, that because you can, if you don't like the voice activated, or if you're using non-Siri, you can press and hold the Beats button, and that will trigger the assistant of your choice on Android. And also, it'll do like the independent, both sides have controls, all that stuff they say works great with Android. So it's just the instant pairing and switching between devices that you lose out on.
Yeah,
that's really cool. But I will say that my disconnect with headphones is that I can spend up to $100 before I start to wonder why I'm spending more than $100 on convenient headphones. Like I can tell the difference between like these really, you know, the stock Sony, like $100 studio headphones. And occasionally I'll be sent like a $400 pair to try out. And yes, I can definitely hear the difference. And yes, if I really did a lot of headphone listening, I might make that buy. I have a hard time often trying to figure out, well, why would I spend $200 on a pair of earbuds? And do you have any thoughts? I know it's only been a day, but do you have any thoughts about like what makes the price worth it?
I think that the sound quality of these are incredible. I've tested a lot of different headphones, and when it comes to earbuds, not as many, but this is absolutely the best sound quality I've heard from earbuds for in-ear headphones, not over the ear headphones. So they've clearly done a lot of work to really get a good, full, robust, thick sound. Here's an example. I was listening. The first song that I played as soon as I put these headphones on was
Sick Burn.
The first album. No, no. That would be so.
Why wouldn't you listen to your own music first? You know what it's supposed to sound like.
I don't know who that lead singer is, but her vocal dynamics is thrilling. I can't even pay attention to the sound quality.
So I listened to Lincoln by They Might Be the Giants, and I have been listening to.
You are a nerd. You are a nerd.
Yeah. 150 times in my lifetime.
We're trying to get them because they have a new album. We're trying to get them on the triangulation.
Oh, yeah. Let me come along with that one. That'd be so cool.
You know what?
their new album just came out 2 days ago.
Deal. If we get them, if we can get John and John, let's have John and Lori.
That would be so cool.
The only thing I want to add is that I don't know the answer to this, but I have a feeling that Beats now has Apple has built this incredible acoustic lab in Cupertino. And I went in there with a bunch of audio analysts for the HomePod tour.
Right.
And they're like, we've been in these things all over the world. And this is by far the biggest one of these we've ever been in. And if all the Beats engineers now have access to that technology, that in itself would be elevating in terms of what they could produce.
And Renee, that's why I pointed out that it felt to me the same experience I had when I listened to music through a HomePod for the first time, which obviously I'm not trying to say that these are as like sound quality as a HomePod, but it was immediately, I was taken aback by how clear and bright and robust the music was. So this idea of the sound lab that Beats has access to, so that they can really perfect the equalization of the balance of music, I believe that is what's happening, because I'm very impressed with the sound quality of these things, more than I've ever been with any pair of headphones.
Now,
my thing is the opposite. Like, I'm the opposite of a golden ears. I said in my review, I'm a fool's golden ears, because I really can't tell that much about sound.
Well, sounds good to me.
I used to listen to MacBreak Weekly on the speaker of my iPhone 3GS, you know, like, and it was fine for me.
You savage.
I know. But like, so for me, the whole value prop here is the convenience. Like, you have this little case, you pop it open, you put it in your ear. There's no wire, nothing pulling on you, nothing pulling on them. You go out, you walk, you run, you bicycle, you listen to stuff, you take it out, it stops, you put it in, it goes, you just say things and it happens. And that to me is well worth my money, because it feels like we're a long way away from it, but it feels like this is the first ear computer. Like, computers went from our desks to our laps to our hands to our pockets to our wrists, and now they're starting to go in our ears. And when you start factoring in like audio AR and all the other stuff that's coming, and as the watch does more of the phone stuff, it feels like AirPods and now anything with an H1 chip will start doing more of what the watch did eventually. And to me, that's super, like, hella exciting.
Cool.
I love it so much.
That's cool. Yeah, it's great.
Here's one last abstract question. Like, when Apple bought Beats, I thought that was a really weird purchase, because I didn't associate Beats headphones with the sort of quality and build quality and audio and really nitpickiness to detail that Apple associated with. And I started wondering if Apple does continue to make headphones, will there be like a Beats line, which is sort of like the subway wearer, the sort of street wearer company? And then if they make a set of headphones that's really, really good that everyone would like, they would put the Apple logo on it. So that was an interesting development for me that they made a great pair of headphones.
Yeah, I think the difference is actually in the design. It comes the way it looks. The AirPods are certainly better designed. The way they look, the way they fit, the way they feel, the container they come in, the design is much better. But the Beats line has their own separate design, which frankly isn't as high quality of a design, but is a much, much higher quality of an audio experience.
Great.
Do they support, Bluetooth 5? Do they support aptX?
I don't know. I don't know what they do on Android, because Apple's using their own special sauce.
Oh, Apple doesn't have aptX.
Okay.
I don't know what they mention it. Okay.
But I think like the rumor is that Apple's going to make their own over-the-ear headcans, ProPods. I don't know what they're going to call AirCans, ProPods. And that means like the Beat lines will be the Beats line, but there'll be an Apple line as well. And I think the Apple line will always be the premium line. Or not the premium line. It'll be like you get as many choices as you want as long as they're white. And then Beats will be like where they experiment with.
Yeah.
Like more colors, more styles, more designs.
It doesn't feel like a natural thing that at some point they will put the Siri name on a pair of headphones to say, not that it
wasn't so damaged.
They might say with Siri. You see a lot of devices. You see a lot of devices say with Echo.
No, but I think that they use HomeKit, which I think is a terrible name, and they should use Apple Home instead. Like that's, but I think they don't use Works with Siri because it would be an obvious joke, you know, right after that. And I think they really have years, and like, because Siri is still Assistant Zero, they can always put something in the onboarding procedure to reintroduce it to you. But it's got to have like 2 years of rehabilitation before I'd use Siri in any branding. I think, you know, it's just the way it is at this point.
Mark Gurman in Bloomberg, along with Matthew Townsend. How the Apple Store lost its luster. We've talked a little bit about troubles at the Apple Store. This blames Angela Arendt and a shift in interviews. This is a quote from the article. In interviews, current and former Apple employees blame a combination of factors. They say the stores have become mostly an exercise in branding and no longer do a good job serving shoppers. The quality of staff has slipped during an 18-year expansion that's seen Apple open more than 500 locations, hire 70,000 people. The Genius Bar has largely been replaced with staff who roam the stores and are harder to track down. And maybe it's this was under Aaron's. So first, yeah, do you accept?
I don't know how accurate that is, because like I, there are definitely problems in the Apple stores. I think the branding isn't really what it was. Is that Apple had this idea in their mind to change them from from retail locations to these educational community meccas, and that may or may not be a good idea, but that it is an idea that fundamentally changes the balance of the store when you have creative pros now, not just technical pros. The geniuses didn't change. The geniuses are all still there. They're not behind a bar. They're at a table, but they didn't move. And the geniuses certainly aren't roaming around there. They're fixed in one place, but there are other people who are roaming around. They never had cash registers, so they don't have them now. So like, I think a lot of this is like misplaced anger. I think the biggest thing, though, is the scaling. When the Apple Store started, they had Macs and they had iPods to deal with, and that was it. And they had very few locations, and they had very few staff, and they could really focus on a lot of that stuff. And now they have an incredible range of products, multiple generations of each product, and they're in so many locations that they're having to do things like hub systems, which are terrible for like a person, but are very good for moving vast amounts of things around. So not everything gets repaired in store. Some of it goes to the regional hub to get repaired because that's cost effective, even if it's not, you know, time effective for the customer in there. And these are all absolutely problems, but I think it's hard to, like, the direction wasn't just Angela, that was a company direction. And Ron Johnson never had to deal with the amount of products or the amount of stores that Angela had to.
Gurman writes, one of Angela Arendt's first moves was to turn the stores into town squares where shoppers could hang out and, in industry parlance, spend time with the brand. Lines at the Genius Bar would have spoiled the effect, so stores started replacing the beloved customer service counters with Genius Groves, tables, and roaming geniuses. Checkout counters also disappeared in favor of salespeople armed with mobile devices. The goal was to make Apple stores more like luxury showrooms, pushing off stage the unseemly business of checking out and fielding complaints. Meanwhile, Aaron's began moving sales and service onto the web, encouraging staff to tell customers, get in line online. Customers were told to make an appointment on Apple's website and then pick up the product at a store. You could say it was just to try to streamline things, to speed things up, but Gurman's...
To scale them.
To scale them. But Gurman's saying, well, it was also a focus on making a brand impression over serving customers.
She cared like super. She cared so much. Like, again, like there are a lot of people who like Angela, a lot of people who did not like Angela. But she cared incredibly about the customer experience, like to the extent that she obliterated the lineups, which were great marketing for Apple.
Right.
Because she thought they were terrible.
But not good experience for customers. Yeah. And I agree.
No, and she implemented all of that.
And by the way, Apple's not the only place to do that. You go into an AT&T store these days or a Comcast store these days, it's exactly the same experience where you meet a greeter who then adds your name to a list so that there aren't lines. You can browse around and be called on.
I would like Disney
time.
Lines. Like, put lines in, but make them an event. Like when you're lining up for the Indiana Jones ride. You know, make it part of the experience.
She also killed something that we really liked, and I recommend it all the time, the one-on-one training sessions, replacing them with free group sessions. Those were $99 a year with free group sessions. But I know a lot of people, especially seniors, who really valued the one-on-one and really got something out of it and who do not find the group sessions at all useful.
My mom did the 101. She really liked them. But again, that proved hard to scale as they introduced really popular products. The groups are really good. I've sat in on quite a few of them. And like, you can get the WWDC prototyping. I know that appeals to a very small amount of people, but that prototyping course from WWDC is one of the most profound things. If you ever want to design an app that you can sit in on, and now you can sit on it at most major Apple stores. And that's kind of incredible. And they do have like photo walks. There's a lot of really good courses there for people who do want to just go there. And you can, even if you have an Android phone, you can just go in and take them for free.
During the Johnson era, Ron Johnson, of course, who left to go to Penny's, sales associates got 3 weeks to a month of training. Now they get about a week if they're joining an existing store. Geniuses who earn $22 an hour on average were trained at Apple's Cupertino, California headquarters. Now they're mostly trained in store. Andy, do you agree with Mark's contention that the expertise of the staff has gone down at Apple stores?
I wouldn't say so, because usually the complaints that or the problems that people bring in their devices with are usually fairly consistent. So it's very, very easy to train most or if not all of their staff to deal with 90% of the problems. And I have found at least that there is always sometimes they might escalate a problem to let's get Janine. Janine knows all about sync problems, and we'll have the people who have the more in-depth knowledge. But I think the bigger problem is that the worst of Apple Store experiences has become lower. I don't necessarily think that there have been more bad Apple experiences. Just that when you hear a horror story, it's bad. And that never used to really happen. I will say that Gurman, in the Post, makes a point about how undifferentiated the store is. That you don't know where to go. It's not like an old fashioned store where there are like these plastic signs hanging from the ceiling that here's where the underpants are, here's where the groceries are. I gotta say that one of the subtle but brilliant things about how an Apple store is laid out is that the user interface is always human. You don't walk in and then try to figure out where, there's the sign saying where the iPhone cases are. I pick one up and now where's the sign that says where the checkout is? I go there, wait in line and then get processed through. You are met at the door by someone who asks you what you want. And then they will tell you and show you exactly where to go. And then you actually go to a human being who will stand up with a device focusing solely on you without a counter between you. I do think that's a subtle amount of a brain hack that Apple is doing to underscore the humanity and the empathy of the entire brand. So I do think that the article points out some things that Apple still needs to work on, but I don't think it's anywhere near a crisis point.
Historically, Apple stores have been incredibly profitable. As recently as 2 years ago, $5,500 in sales per square foot, making it more profitable than Tiffany, the most profitable retail experience anywhere. Of late, Lori, did they mention anything in the quarterly results about retail? It seems like they're not touting that like they used to.
Yeah, you know, that's true. That they will oftentimes tell you about new stores that they've just opened up and how well the stores are doing. And I don't remember hearing anything about that called out specifically in the quarterly earnings. But to this particular article, I think Renee really put a pin in that real easy, which is that it's the scale. It's that it's scaled up so much in the last few years that the experience has it's just grown a lot, and there's more to do. Not just in how many stores they have or what they offer, but how many people go into that store. And 15 years ago, you know, us Apple nerds would go into an Apple store and we knew what to expect. We knew what we were supposed to be looking for and who we were supposed to be talking to and how we should go about getting that. But somebody who's brand new to the Apple ecosystem, maybe they only have an iPhone, maybe they only have an iPad. If they walk into that experience, that's not a familiar experience. And even that first step through the front door where, Andy, what you were saying is somebody greets you and tells you where to go or what to do next, or they help you. If you walk into a store where that greeter is having a bad day, or if they're extra busy that day and they don't notice you, you are completely lost in that store and don't know what
that's
to do next if you're new to this experience.
There's no
and
flow.
I think that's
also, if the manager is bad, like the stores vary now a lot more based on, like, if you have a great manager, it's the best store in the world. If you have a bad manager, it's a terrible experience.
Another problem is that Apple faces is the simple fact that most mall stores are designed to be very, very deep as opposed to wide.
Right.
And the problem of having a deep, deep store is that you can't really just stand and look around and see what you got, where everything is. You really do have to walk and explore. And given how busy almost every Apple store is at any time where people are not at work, you're really going to have to hunt. It's almost like being at a flea market.
Well, I have to say that the Grand Central Station store is really a template in a way. It is kind of like a big train station
these days. It's like a flea market almost.
When you walk into an Apple store, there aren't any signposts. There's no aisles. It's not easy to say, oh, I'm going here, I'm going here. That's by design. I don't know if it's a bad experience or not. The new chief of Apple retail, Deidre O'Brien, is still in charge of people. She was in charge of HR. Will open her first store in 3 days. At the Carnegie Library in Washington, D.C. So we'll take a look at that. I have three Apple stores near me, two mall stores, and then, of course, the beautiful San Francisco Union Square store. And they are, you're right, Andy, completely different experiences.
I have to say that the Carnegie the new Carnegie store is in DC really made me feel very, very happy and very, very pleased with what Apple is doing. This is really a beautiful historic building designed by McKim, Mead & White, which was, if you were designing a palace, either a public or a private palace in the late 1800s, early 20th century, this is the firm that you wanted to get. Although kind of like you're by default, your first, oh God, a corporation has just bought out this old building and oh, they're going to turn it into a Starbucks. Apple did spend a lot of money just on the preserving the facade of the place. And this is a place that was unrentable really for years and years and years. And these places, they fall into disrepair because they need maintenance and they need love. And it wasn't turned into condos. It's still a public space in the sense that, yes, it's leased by Apple and it's an Apple store, but anybody can walk in at any time and sit down somewhere and use the Wi-Fi. So they're taking this building that would be in danger of being stripped of its original purpose and at least turning it into something that is stable, that's going to have another life for the next 10 years, and is still going to be a place where people can walk in and enter as opposed to being turned into a really expensive restaurant that you can't even get reservations for.
It is a beautiful building. I have some images here from...
If you don't care about the retail experience and you just love architecture, some of the buildings that they've put up around the world are just breathtaking.
Yeah. This looks very much like a regular Apple store, but you see the building that it's in, the Carnegie Library, which is a classic, you know, kind of Washingtonian building. That should be a very nice place for it.
It's super impressive. The fact that they could build a design a store for downtown Chicago that would compete with Chicago architecture, but also be right on front with the one city that still has like architecture critics on the newspaper staff. That showed how confident they were that they can bring it.
Hey, is the Fifth Avenue store reopened yet, or is it still under construction? Does anybody know?
I think it's still under construction.
That's been a long revamp.
I heard that they have bed bugs. there was a news item that there's like in the former FAO Schwartz that they're temporarily in right next door that they're having a bed bug problem.
Oh dear. That's very bad news. Visit us at our temporary location.
Don't get your headphones there.
Don't get your headphones here. Yeah, it's still not open. If you're in the D.C. area, May 11th, 10 a.m., Apple Carnegie Library opens. And you mentioned we were talking about the headphones. And what was it you mentioned? I can't remember, but it reminded me of the New York Times great piece on the Joco cruises. You know, we love no, this is not it, by the way. This is let me show you this, because this is the creepiest picture I've ever seen.
Oh, weird.
This is Kim Kardashian West. This is last night at the Met Gala. Kim Kardashian West, Kendall Jenner, Jared Leto's head, and Jeff Bezos.
Now, before listeners get excited.
No, well, it was part of his costume.
Before you get excited, he's still alive. It's just a prop. He has not received karmic retribution for 70% of his film role.
Extremely. Did Bezos get that to her in a day? Was that same day delivery of the head?
Extremely disturbing. But I was on my way to the Joco cruise article. Great article about the Jonathan Colton cruise. Have any of you ever gone on that?
Nope.
No, but this I've come close when friends are going and have asked, hey, you want to join us? And I always balk like at the price and at the week that it happens. But now after this, particularly after reading this article, I'm really kind of keen on going next year or the year after. I mean, my fear has been like, as a nerd, I have often spent a day at events that are entirely packed with nerds who are fans of one thing. And I enjoyed the day, but I was glad that I was not stuck on a ship for 1 week with
Well, you know this boat. This is the MS Oosterdam, which I think we've had a couple of MacMania cruises on. This one now, the Joco cruise is so successful. Jonathan Colton, who's of course, everybody loves Code Monkey, and Paul and Storm put it together. Every year, people like science fiction author John Scalzi come aboard. They are so successful, they now buy the entire boat. 2,000 nerds doing all sorts of cray-cray stuff, including cosplay day. You get a button when you check in that indicates whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. it either says yeah or no to conversation.
Meaning yes, but by all means, come up and start a conversation with me versus, you know what, I'd kind of rather just sit and watch.
They call them friendshipping buttons. You get your choice of a big green yay or a big red nah.
What, can you get two? Can you get one of each just in case one?
Yeah, I think you should,
like,
for the day. Here they are. This is mer monkeys.
Tied to blood alcohol level, which is automatically sensitive. Changes color.
It sounds like a lot of fun. And of course, there's a lot of video gaming and tabletop gaming going on. great article. Good coverage. I have a feeling now they're going to have to rent two boats. For the JoCo cruise. Let's take a little break. More to come with our great panel. Renee Ritchie, Lori Gill from iMore, Andy Anatko from WGBH Boston. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. Love these guys. In fact, they pretty much began with us. It turned out Tim Broom and Don Pezet were traditional IT trainers, classroom IT trainers to teach people the skills they needed to get the certifications they needed to get the job in IT they wanted. And they went to an NAB conference and saw a panel. I was on the panel with some others about streaming video. And they said, hey, we could do that with IT training. And IT Pro TV was born. And I think they were the first place they ever advertised. And now some years later, boy, are they amazing. They've got a beautiful facility with 5 studios. They're doing live shows Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, thousands of hours of on-demand training, new training all the time. Whether you're an experienced IT professional and you just want to, keep your chops up or learn new skills, or you're trying to get into the field, there's never been a better time than right now to take advantage of IT Pro TV's lowest prices ever. Standard membership, which is a video-only membership, you get all the videos, all the on-demand stuff, watch all the classes you want, as much as you want, $28.50 a month. The premium membership, which includes all of that, plus labs, so you can set up a Windows server and Windows clients from an HTML5 browser, which is pretty amazing, and practice exams, so you can take the tests before you take the test. That's $42 a month, but that's not the price you pay, because they love Twit listeners, and they're going to honor that special offer. We've had that for some time now. 30% off, and not just for the first month or year, but for the lifetime of your active account. That means the standard membership is now less than $20 a month, or if you buy a year, less than $200 a year. The premium membership, $29.50 a month, or less than $300 for a year. Less than $1 a day for the best, most fun, most engaging training in every area of IT, and you can watch it any way you want. Of course, they have iOS and Android apps, but you can watch it in your browser. You can Chromecast it to your TV. They have a Roku app that's great, Fire TV app, Apple TV app. New content is added every single day, so your training's always aligned with the latest certs, the most current exams. I mean, and when I say current, they go from their studios to the web to the on-demand section within a day, within 24 hours. They are now CompTIA's official video training partner. So they've got 12 CompTIA on-demand courses. And these are really the certs a lot of people get into IT with, A+, Network Plus, Security Plus. So here's the deal. Visit their website. Look at this. Look at that. That was a hell of a computer they were building. Look at that. These guys are great. They're fun. They're engaging. There's a chat room going on. Just fantastic job. go.itpro.tv/MacBreak. If you want to find out more, if you use the offer code MacBreak30, you'll get that 30% discount for life right away. MacBreak30. Don't let another season pass you by without getting that cert, getting that great new job, or getting a better job. go.itpro.tv/MacBreak. The offer code is MacBreak30. IT Pro TV, flexible training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results. And I'm just so proud of how well they've done it. We thank them so much for their support. And you support us by using that offer code. go.itpro.tv/MacBreak. Offer code MacBreak30. 2,000 nerds on a boat. It's either your worst nightmare or a dream come true, right?
That's the name of my next song.
2,000 Nerds on a Boat. Man, I love it. Let's see here. So I don't know if this was to steal Google's thunder or not, but I thought we'd give you a chance to talk about all the new operating systems which just came out. Updates for Mac OS, TV OS, Watch OS. Anything to say about that, Renee? Were you busy downloading?
Yeah, I mean, well, Apple does not really happy when Gurman or Rambo spill their iOS beans. They'd much rather surprise people at the show. So the timing for this was probably just that Guy went and then Mark decided he had to go. And
right.
It all worked out this way. So Not happy times in Cupertino. But the way I look at it is, if you like spoilers, if you feel anxious, if you want to take the edge off of what you think you're going to see, go read them. If you don't want to be spoiled, avoid them. If you do read them, then don't call the event boring later, because reading the script to Star
People
Wars
do that.
Means like they do. They read the script to Star Wars, then say the movie didn't surprise
nothing
them.
Nothing new.
That's not fair.
But yeah, so that's right. Don't read. Here. So June 3rd, WWDC, we will, of course, just as we did yesterday with Build and today with Google I.O., we will cover the keynote on June 3rd. There will be new iPhone, iPad, Mac, Apple Watch, and Apple TV stuff. There'll be lots of new features, particularly don't show this. That's spoiler alert.
You can say it.
You made me feel guilty now. I don't want to spoil it for anybody.
Snap his finger.
I cover the stuff, and I had this whole conversation with Dalrymple once, and he said, like, you've got to help people understand this stuff, and if they don't want to read it, that's up to them, but it's your job to cover it. So I cover all this too. It's just, and the stuff here, a lot of it is super interesting, because last year Apple postponed a lot of stuff so that they could go in and do the performance enhancements and optimization. And this year it looks like they're continuing it. And I was wondering, is this going to be a one-year thing? Because it's super costly for Apple. They take the best and the brightest engineers, people who are legit famous in the community for inventing frameworks that we use every day, and they had them go and just make those work better on older devices instead of making the new next thing. And they're doing a little bit of that this year too. So it's nice to see that Apple's not just saying. And it baffles Wall Street. Every time I'm on one of those shows, they always say, why is Apple trying to get us to keep their old phones longer? Isn't that bad for them? I don't understand. And the thing is, Apple's moved now to install base. They want to be able to say there's so many devices out there and they're all working great. And you know, we can sell subscriptions to all of them. So they're going to be doing a lot of performance enhancement. There'll be basic things like dark mode, which Apple has been tormenting us with for years. It's like the Apple Watch came out with dark mode. And they're like, we're going to give you dark mode for the Apple TV. What? We're going to give you dark mode for the Mac. And now finally we're getting dark mode for the iPhone, along with a lot of other enhancements to a lot of core features. And you know what we were talking about earlier, which is just the I totally lost my track of thought there. But just the ability to use a lot of these technologies between devices, like the Apple Watch is going to tie into bedtime, because bedtime by itself on an iPhone, not that useful. And the Apple's going to be bringing a lot of apps from the iPhone, Marzipan, for example, all the iPhone stuff is going to be able to work on the Mac. And you never know, like for me, it's not so much what they're doing, it's how they execute it that really matters. So we'll have to wait till June 3rd for that. But there's a lot of stuff in here I think is hugely exciting.
I'm excited about WatchOS 6. Will that be, do we know, I guess we don't know yet, which versions of the Apple Watch will be compatible? Will it? It won't go all the way back to zero.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't now. But there's a fear that Apple is going to jet, because they've kept right now, basically anything with 64-bit works in terms of iPhone. That goes all the way back to iPhone 5S with the A7 chip. And Apple has gotten rid of A9, I think, pretty much completely. But A8 is still out there.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see if they sunset A8, because then that's a lot of devices that suddenly go off the radar.
Right. Well, that's it. We're not going to spoil it for you. Just know that we will see a lot of new stuff. We've talked in broad brush strokes about iOS 13 and how it's going to make the iPad a little bit more work friendly.
Too.
That could be very big. macOS 10.15. Now they won't push that out till the fall, or will they?
Well, it'll be the developer beta will be the day of WWDC, okay. And then the public beta like 2 weeks later, and then the release like in September.
Okay.
But even like it sounds increasingly like the apps we got last year were like Marzipan, not even alpha. It's like we've got to make sure the news app is out because we have a News Plus coming, and we've got to make sure the voice memos app is out because it's syncing, and we're just going to put them out. But it sounds like the Marzipan we're getting, if you follow Steve Trotten Smith on Twitter, which you absolutely should do, he's Marzipanifying everything. Wow. It is ridiculous. That's all the apps he's helping people do.
That's converting iOS apps to run on Mac.
Yeah, so basically UIKit running on the Mac, and not just in a wrapper, which is what they do now, but almost like a first-class citizen.
Interesting.
And they're getting many more bells and whistles and many more Mac-like affordances and integrations. And iOS, especially the iPad, is going to get the ability to have multiple instances of the same app, which also plays into having those apps run on the Mac, because it's not just a nice-to-have, it's sort of a must-have on the Mac. We're all used to multi-window workflows.
So while Marzipan is intended to improve the Mac by making iOS apps work on it, it's going to have some effect in the opposite direction. It's going to change a little bit about how iOS works and what you can expect in iOS.
Well, iOS is getting more mature, so it can make for better cross-platform Mac apps. It's sort of, I want to be careful because people often think, oh, my favorite Mac app is going to come to iOS. And it does not help you with that at all.
But yeah. I do have to think that people designing iOS apps from now on will kind of keep this in mind.
And the iOS apps are getting more capabilities, so that they're not more Mac. See, that's the whole thing. Is like one of the big debates is like you don't want to just copy paste stuff from the Mac to iOS, because some of that stuff may not have been the best solution, especially not in a multi-touch world. So like drag and drop got rethought, and now multi-windowing. And there was some language in Mark's report, like he was talking about being able to swipe through different versions of an app. And is that tabs? Is that frames? Like, what does that actually mean? How is that implemented? And that's like the super interesting part, is what the human interface team chooses to show us as manifestations of all of these ideas.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I hope that the overall game plan for Marzipan is to increase the value of the investment that a developer makes in learning how to develop apps for iOS and Macintosh by saying that, no, you no longer have to learn UIKit and something else. If you learn how to build an app with this basic framework, if you then decide that you have a new idea for an app that involves Macintosh, you don't have to climb this hurdle. They want to make sure that they kind of erase the boundary between being an iOS developer and a Mac developer. That's good for the industry. That's good for developers, and ultimately good for consumers. One of the other bad things about how they handled Marzipan last year was, again, releasing Mac versions of iOS apps that just really looked like I'm running a virtual iPad in a Macintosh window. There's just nothing about those apps that it really didn't feel like it was designed with a Macintosh in mind. So I'm trying to reserve judgment until we see those next generations of apps where someone says, we've finished the core functionality of this text editor or to-do list or whatever, and now we are going to split the development into, now we're going to make choices that are specifically for Mac, and now we're going to make choices that are specifically for iOS. If it becomes a way for people to simply say, well, why should we continue to develop on macOS when we can just add an extra week to our development schedule and cut and paste stuff into a new build a version of iOS app for Mac, that's a bad thing. That's at WWDC, what I'm looking for is more signs that Apple is interested in the Mac and they're fascinated by the Mac and they want the Mac to live on for another 5 years.
We mentioned that Tim Cook was at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting. It kind of makes sense. Warren Buffett is a big stockholder in Apple.
How much does it cost to get Tim Cook to show up at your party?
Well, billions.
Or to make you an
app. Here's Yeezy's price.
Well, and that's the funny thing, because at first it seemed like a promo. At the start of the shareholder meeting, Tim Cook made a cameo appearance in a humorous short film in which Buffett visits a top secret lab at Apple to try to come up with ideas for an app, including a time machine where Buffett tells his childhood self, buy Apple stock. Good advice. Cook suggests in the video a newspaper-tossing iPhone game, because Buffett used to have a paper route.
Stole my pick in the week, Leo. Just kidding.
Is it your pick of the week? I won't say a word if it is. It's a real game. Warren Buffett's Paper Wizard. It's now free on the App Store. You will you'll collect Warren Bucks as you travel around Cupertino delivering newspapers. Actually, you start in Cupertino. You end up in Omaha,
I started in Omaha because
you did.
I think that's because that's the easier level, because it's not quite so built up. You get to ride a lot between houses. It's when you get into Cupertino, they start you off in the suburbs where the houses only cost $1.5 million, and then you end up in the high rise district.
Oh, I get it. So you start in Omaha. That's the beginner level. I get it.
Yeah.
Looks like this isn't your first paper route, says Emoji Tim.
I'm not sure that I was kind of surprised that they were so upbeat, because I was getting, but at the very, very last levels where you have to shoot into high rises, like rapid fire, like top level, low levels. And I was getting like 42% delivered. And I'm not sure that my boss would say of the 100 people who subscribed to the paper, 58 of them did not receive their newspaper and lots of other people got their windows broken. Good job.
Actually sounds about right. at least according to my experience as a paper boy. Somebody who accidentally swallowed an AirPod.
Oh, do we even have to talk about
this enough.
One?
Let's just point out that it continued to work even in the guy's stomach.
They work better externally than internally. Test subject. Yeah.
There it is. You can see it in the x-ray right there. That's an AirPod. Jeez, please don't swallow your AirPod.
I just question how accidental this swallowing was. That's all. I'm just,
according to the Daily Mail, not the most reliable source. A guy named Ben Shu fell asleep with a pair of wireless headphones in his ears, but woke up unable to find one of them. He used the iPhone tracking feature to find it in his room, but as he walked around, the beeping sound followed him. He realized the sound is coming from my stomach. He did eventually eliminate it, and it continued to work. In fact, the battery...
How does he know it continued to work? He should have thrown it right out. They're not that expensive.
The battery was 41%. It was incredible, said Shu. My experience was magical. I hope Tim Cook uses that at WWDC.
Oh, go to hell. It wasn't magical. My God. That's got to be the most valuable, like, marketing name to phone number. Say, hey, I've got a Macintosh that's 8 years old, and I can have it for only $40,000. Yes, this. A magical experience. Oh, my God.
Let's take a break.
How much would you charge to have... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Let's. your indignation is registered, Andrew.
there's being a fan of Apple, and then there's taking it to a level that's maybe unhealthy for both you and the company.
And Tim Cook says, "Son, just calm down."
How long before we get little slips of paper inside of AirPods that say not to be taken internally?
Oh God!
All it takes is one, just one. Let's take a break. Your picks of the week coming up, but first a word from Capterra. Actually, this is a great way to get a pick of your favorite business software. How many of you? I know most. You know, yesterday Microsoft said, hey, good news in our brand new Edge browser running on Chromium. You'll still be able to run Internet Explorer for those of you with business software that requires IE8. They even showed a web page. It really looked like it was straight out of 1995. It had the gray table and all of that. If you're in that position where you have business software that the guy who wrote it has graduated from elementary school and has disappeared, you need to go to Capterra.com to find new, modern, fancy business software that'll do more of what you need it to do, and you won't need to run Internet Explorer 6 to do it. If you're just starting out or your business is growing and it's time to change the software, you'd like to try new software, Capterra is there to help. A directory, more than 700 categories of business software, from CMS to email marketing to IT service, SEO, workflow management, yoga studio management, veterinary dentist's office management. I can go on and on and on. Thousands of programs. It makes it very easy to find what you want, because once you get the category, once you get the program category, then you can drill down. You could say, well, I don't want to see ones with 5-star ratings. I only want to see them if they operate on my desk or they operate in the cloud. You could actually, I want to be able to book clients or all the things that you might want. And then once you filter them, you can even compare them side by side, 4 at a time. You can see related categories, but here's the best part about Capterra, in my opinion. 875,000 reviews by actual verified users. And there's 30,000 fresh reviews every month. That's 1,000 a day. So that makes a huge difference. When you're looking at a piece of software and somebody says, yeah, I use this and this is what I like, this is what I don't like, super valuable. That's Capterra. Capterra believes software can make the world a better place because it can help every organization become more efficient, a more effective version of itself. And here's the best part. I've kind of buried the lead. It's free. Free. Like, no, not freemium. It's free. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software for you, solution for your business. CAPTERRA.com/MacBreak. Go to CAPTERRA.com/MacBreak. And you know, you'll get the same thing if you didn't go to MacBreak. But this way, you let them know you heard it on the show, and that helps us. And we really do thank Capterra for not only providing a great product free to all the business owners in the world, but telling the world about it on our show. Thank you, Capterra. Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/MacBreak. Capterra is software selection simplified. Lori Gill?
That's my name.
What should I buy this week?
So my original pick was actually the Power Beats Pro, but since we spent the first half of the show talking about
That's okay.
I have a backup. I have a backup.
Okay.
I think that everybody should get Whoosh.
Whoosh. What is Whoosh?
It is a screen cleaner.
Oh.
So it's, you know, just wipes down your screen, cleans it off. So especially when it comes to the iPad, the iPhone screen, you can usually use just your standard micro cleaning cloth, and you can pretty much get the fingerprints off. But when you have your iPad, I don't know if you guys have tried just using a damp cloth.
No, it leaves streaks. No.
And it just looks awful.
Yeah.
And I actually will just like, you know, like you breathe heavy on it and then wipe it down to try to like get some of that moisture from my mouth to try to clean it off. It never works. Whoosh, just a couple of wipes and it's perfect, like it's brand new. And you don't use very much. You actually spray it on the cleaning cloth, not on your screen directly. So it's like you're using a damp cloth. It's just that the damp cloth has the stuff in it that actually works to clean the screen. And it's biodegradable and it's you could eat it, you could drink it.
non-toxic.
Thank you.
Wow.
It's non-toxic. It's not damaging to screens. You know, I know that Apple always says don't use chemicals on screens, but this company has been around for quite a few years now, has successfully worked on all manner of screens without damaging them. So it uses a very
light. It even comes with an antimicrobial cloth with the poop emoji on it.
Well, mine didn't actually come with
the poop emoji. You didn't get their bonus item.
I did not. No. Thank goodness.
So John, I'm ordering 4 of these right now for the studio. I think we need Whoosh. Are you ordering them?
They really.
Look at that. It smells good too.
And they really help clean the screens on an iPad. For me, I don't even want to touch my iPad screen because it's big and beautiful, and just one swipe and I've destroyed
it. You
kind
of have to touch it.
Yeah, and so this lets me every day or every couple of days, I'll just wipe it down and it looks brand new again. If I'm having to take pictures, which I have to take pictures of my devices all the time for the iMore, all the things that I read about on iMore, I will quickly wipe it down and it gets rid of all of those fingerprints and little bits of dust and stuff like that. It works on headphones. I haven't needed to use it on the Power Beats Pro yet, but when I do, I can wipe it down with that.
Just ordered
a really great
that big squirt bottle you see. I just ordered 3 of those. But it turns out Megan just came running in. We have Whoosh. I'm going to try it right now because it's not just for iPads. I have a giant Surface display here. Let me just.
Do you have the cleaning cloth on you?
Yeah, except it's spraying in every direction but where I want it to go. Maybe there's a. Let's see.
And here's you were supposed to spray it on the cloth, not the screen. So.
Oh, there's the problem right there. I always spray it on the screen direct. I figure, why intercede? Why become an inter? It does. It is. I need to fix the squirter. It smells good. So, and in no streaks.
Yeah, Whoosh. It just. It's so nice.
Look at that.
It's non-alcoholic. I'm not sure the chemicals in it.
It smells pretty good.
It doesn't list it on here. But
I think Megan's been cleaning bicycle tires with it, though. This cloth is not in good shape. She's doing her white walls outside. All right. Whoosh. Thank you for the recommendation. Again, I only buy stuff that Lori recommends. I have all the
what
stuff.
What can I say?
All the things. Andy Inokko, pick of the week.
My pick of the week is something I've been looking for a long, long time. This is it's the Light Labs Q22 flash. So a camera flash. But here's what makes it something I've been looking for a long, long time. Number one, I don't like to my good flash is like really, really big, so I almost never take it with me. I kind of wanted to have like a travel something that's pocketable and tiny, and this is absolutely both of those things. But also, you can find these tiny little flashes, but they don't do a whole lot. This one is amazing. So not only does it work on a flash, and I'm using it on my like Micro Four Thirds camera, but a lot of like the pocket cameras that come for like $500-$700 have a hot shoe, have a flash shoe on it. So it's not just for like big cameras. But so you press this button on the back and release it, and it becomes an off-camera flash, so that you can, instead of having like the light right in people's faces or right in the thing's faces, you can have it like off to the side. And not only that, but you can also, with buttons that are on the back of this little sender unit, adjust like the intensity of the flash. So if you set it up like 10 feet away to get a picture of something, and then you realize it's a little bit too bright, that's okay. You can adjust it from here. Not only that, but it also has a bounceable head. So you can flick this up and bounce things off the ceiling. Not only that, but there's a little slot in the bottom here. So if you want to add like a color gel to it, and it comes with a pack of them, you just slide it in here. So I put this in so like skin tones are a little bit more natural. Not only that, and in addition to like all the controls that like are in the back here, so you can control it like yourself, it also has, you see this white strip down here, that is also an LED video light, he said, holding down the button. There we go. Oh, you can't see it because I've got my own lights on. But so that means that if you are recording video with this thing, it'll be like the battery's supposed to be dead because I've been using it all the time. If you're recording video, it'll be like an LED illuminator. Or if you're taking a picture with your phone, you can use this as sort of an off-camera illuminator. And then, I mean, just all these things that are just such smart things, such as it also has a standard tripod screw like in the bottom. So if you want to stick it on like a GorillaPod or something like that, so that if you got it off camera, maybe you need to mount it someplace neat. It will run off of two AA batteries. But if you put NiCads in there, it not only does it run on NiCads, but you can also charge the NiCads directly through the flash. So if you have it has a standard like micro USB port on the side of that for charging, so you don't have to like bring a battery charger with you. It will just charge directly from there. And the little sender unit that screws into the hot shoe, it has its own lithium ion battery, so it doesn't drain your own camera. But another smart thing, you can recharge it not only from your phone charger, but you can also plug it into this and recharge it from the AA batteries off of this. So it's all this for like $70. And you can also add more flashes to it. So if you want to have two flashes, three flashes controlled remotely, you can just add more flashes or buy a little shoe that will attach to the bottom of a standard flash. Only for like $60-$70 for just the basic kit. And like I said, it's not just that it's a pocketable flash that I can bear to put in my laptop bag and carry around with me. It's that every opportunity they had to make it cooler or make it more useful or to avoid something stupid that gets in the way of what you want to do, they avoided it. I mean, even just the fact that they made all of the sides of this square, so you can just basically just put this on a shelf or put this like on a railing, it will stop. I know that a rounded edge would have been cooler and more industrial designy, but it would have stopped you from doing something interesting with the thing. So I'm really, I bought it last week. I've been using it all the time. I'm really, really, really happy with it. And like I said, for $70, it's everything that I would have wanted in a device exactly like this.
Very nice. Very nice. Thank you, Andrew. Renee Ritchie, pick of the week time.
So let me tell you a short story about a developer named David Smith, who previously, anytime Apple would announce a new framework, he would instantly at WWDC anywhere have 5 or 6 apps ready to go. He was just one of the most prolific developers I ever knew, probably because of the very fine coffee that he enjoyed. He slowed down recently. I mean, he does Sleep Plus Plus and a bunch of
that's a great app.
a ton of really great apps. He's put out his new app recently. I forget if it was last week, but it was thereabouts, and it's got the magnificent title of Calzones. it's calendar zones, calendar and time zones, but he made it sound pizza delicious, which is just an example of his brilliance. Anyway, this, if you've ever had, and I know everyone here can relate, if you've ever had to set up a podcast with people in many different international time zones, or a meeting, or anything, a phone call, whatever it was, you know how hard it, you're in Melbourne. When is that? Well, what time is it where you are right now? Oh, so if it's 5 o'clock tomorrow, free, and inevitably people show up on the wrong day sometimes, show up at the wrong time. It's just all shades of confusing. So this app, like most good apps, has a very specific purpose, and that's just to let you know what a time is in multiple time zones and let you act on that by creating meetings, suggestions, tracking, doing all sorts of very useful things based on knowing what a time is in multiple time zones. Because it's David Smith, it has a really good, really simple iPhone app, but it also has a really brilliant Apple Watch app that'll show you time zones and like monstrous complication support. So you can go in and set up all sorts of like working day time and time zone time and all these different things and really just adjust your watch face or watch faces if you choose to have multiple in a way that makes a lot of glanceable sense to you. So it's $5, and I still love that David Smith is charging real prices, yes, for real apps. So you can support him and his magnificent work, and it just solves that problem of never needing to worry about what time Russell thinks it is or Mark thinks it is in Melbourne and what time the guest from Italy is coming on. And all of those things just go completely away, and it lets you concentrate on making a good quality meeting or call or podcast and not worrying about three of you being there at eight different times.
This is a must have for podcasters.
Yes. I once, the material podcast for Google stuff, in addition to me on the East Coast, the other hosts were Russell in Australia and Yasmin Evgen in Arizona that doesn't observe
Arizona
daylight savings
everything
time.
Up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was like, what has my life become? I am not one of God's beloved, no, clearly.
I'm spending $5 right now. That's
a
great product.
We had people from Iterate show up on the wrong day. I mean, it was just like, it would just happen.
Yeah. No, it happens all the time. Yeah. Calzones. It also has a great name.
Yes.
On the App Store right now. Just a quick mention. It's not exactly a pick, but thanks to 9to5 Toys, I know this. Today through May 10th, so you got to jump on this one. You only have 3 days. Apple's giving a 10% additional bonus when you add funds to your Apple ID, so up to $200. So if you use Apple Pay to buy stuff, you could buy $200 in funds and save $20 off of that. That's a pretty good deal. 10% off, U.S. only, I'm sorry to say. But just a little tip. On your iPhone or iPad settings, click on your account name, then the iTunes and App Store tab. Choose your Apple ID and then add funds to Apple ID, and you'll get a little bonus if you do it now through May 10th. Friends, we have come to the end of this Mac Break Weekly. Thank you so much, Andy Iannacco, host of the Material Podcast. If you want to walk on the wild side, that's on Relay.fm. You can also hear him on WGBH Boston and each week here. Thank you, Andy.
Thanks.
Lori Gill, managing editor at iMore.com, lead singer for Sick Burn, Appaholic on the Twitter, pink hair wearer. Loving it.
Yeah, right.
Loving it. Thank you so much for being here, Lori.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And, of course, from iMore.com, Renee's chomping at the bit to go out and get a Detective Pikachu photo bomb, so we're going to let him go out and do that. He's also the host of the Vector podcast at iMore.com/Vector. Thank you, Renee.
So much, Leo.
Hey, Renee, I noticed something in the background. Is there something?
Wait, oh my God! Is that a Starbucks coffee cup?
I left a Starbucks coffee cup.
Continuity.
Oh, I'm so embarrassed.
Continuity.
I'm so embarrassed.
I got to reshoot the whole show.
In the timeline of Renee Ritchie, that should be a Tim Hortons cup. Oh, man. How did they miss that?
Made a mistake. It was supposed to be tea.
We're talking, of course, about episode 4, season 8, Game of Thrones. If you watch very carefully, you'll see that Daenerys is drinking a latte in the middle of the show. Well, we don't know if she drinks it. It was sitting there on the table. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We do Mac Break Weekly. Normally, we're an hour delayed thanks to Google I.O., but normally we're about 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time, 1800 UTC. I could tell that thanks to Calzones on my watch. You can use Calzones to figure out when you should watch us. The stream is at twit.tv/live. If you're watching or listening to the live stream, please go in the chat room. That's where everybody else is who's watching or listening live at irc.twit.tv. We also welcome you. We had a great studio audience today from Mason, Wisconsin, and Philadelphia, New Philadelphia, Ohio. What happened to Old Philadelphia, Ohio? New, we've moved Philadelphia to Ohio. So there you go. If you want to be in the studio, we love having studio audiences. Studio is open most days of the week, but do email tickets at twit.tv to let us know you're coming. And, of course, most people watch the easy way, on demand, at your convenience. We make audio and video versions of this show available at twit.tv/MBW. There is the long-lost Alex Lindsay. We still don't know what happened to him, but someday he shall return, I hope. But you know what we got to do is just paste Lori's head on there. That's what we need to do.
I think he's working on Marvel Phase 4.
Shh.
He's working on something that would force him to recuse himself during the show. That's all I know. You be the judge.
Okay, fine. We're suing each other. Okay. I'm sorry that that we tried to hide.
Yeah. Alex Lindsay's been redacted due to grand jury activity. But no, I'm just kidding. But someday he shall return. But you know what? We got a great replacement with Lori Gilbert. Yay. Thrilled to have her. You can download every episode going back to the original Mac Break at twit.tv, but you can also subscribe in your favorite podcaster, and from henceforward, you will get every episode the minute it's available, and I think that's a pretty good idea. Thanks for watching. Now get back to work, because break time is over.